From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, some advice on dealing with the mixed messages we've gotten, like, get on with your normal life, but be prepared for another terrorist attack. We talk with psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton, who has written about the new global terrorism. Also, singer-songwriter Loudon Wainwright performs a new song about New York after September 11th and does a couple of songs from his new CD, Last Man on Earth. He's co-starring in the Fox sitcom Undeclared. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Pentagon officials say U.S. special forces are on the ground in Afghanistan. Their initial mission is to provide assistance to rebel forces opposed to the Taliban regime. From the Pentagon, NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
For weeks, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and other senior Pentagon officials have been saying U.S. Special Operations Forces will play a central role in the Afghanistan war effort. They are expected to provide supplies, advice, and training to the rebel forces fighting there already. U.S. Special Forces are also set to gather intelligence on possible airstrike targets. The Pentagon refuses to say when and where American troops will join the action, but a senior U.S. official now confirms that, in his words, boots are on the ground. Rebel commanders in northern Afghanistan say some U.S. troops showed up this week to help the Northern Alliance. A second official says U.S. Special Forces will also be working in the south of Afghanistan among groups who are opposed to the ruling Taliban regime but not yet part of the war effort there. Tom Gelton, NPR News, The Pentagon.
A New York Post employee who tested positive for anthrax is back at work today. Joanna Huden is an assistant to the tabloid's editorial page editor. The paper says Huden's work includes opening letters to the editor, but that she doesn't remember opening anything suspicious. The source of the anthrax hasn't been identified. Meanwhile, a second New Jersey postal worker with skin anthrax says he's looking forward to getting back to the golf course. The man is a mail sorter at the facility that processed anthrax-laden letters to NBC anchor Tom Brokaw and Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle. The worker says he's doing well and feeling fine. Doctors aren't sure how he got the disease. A military explosive was found today at a bus terminal in the center of Philadelphia. Police say there was no threat of explosion because no detonation cap was attached. Dave Heller of member station WHYY reports.
Philadelphia Police Commissioner John Timoney says some facts have emerged about the suitcase, which contained a third of a pound of C4 explosive and 1,000 feet of detonator cord.
It looks like it around the 29th of September, around 2:43 in the morning, some person, unknown, placed a Samsonite luggage in a locker, one of those rental lockers at the terminal.
The unclaimed suitcase was discovered by a bus station employee who opened it in order to give any clothing inside to charity. Police hope surveillance videos will lead to more information about the owner of the suitcase. For NPR News, I'm Dave Heller in Philadelphia.
Stock prices were slightly higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 41 points, closing at 92.04. Advances led declines by a small margin on volume of 1.3 billion shares. The Nasdaq was up 18 points at 1671, and the S&P 500 was also up 5 points. You're listening to NPR News. Boeing says its commercial airplane division is taking a severe hit from the economic downturn and the struggling airline industry. As a result, the company says its plane production is being cut way back. Sam Eaton of member station KUOW in Seattle reports.
Boeing commercial airplane president Alan Mulally says the company plans to gradually scale back the number of planes it produces each month, cutting the current rate in half by the middle of next year. He says production will likely be reduced even further in 2003. Despite these deep cuts, Mulally is optimistic that a full recovery is on the horizon.
It all goes back to how fast the economy will come back and how fast travel will come back.
Mulally says Boeing expected to cut airplane production even before the September 11th attacks, but those cuts would have been by less than a fourth. Plans to lay off 20 to 30,000 employees still stand, but if Boeing wins the federal contract next week to build the Joint Strike Fighter, as many as 6,000 new jobs would be created in Seattle and St. Louis. For NPR News, I'm Sam Eaton in Seattle.
Six Palestinians were killed today in clashes with the Israeli army in Bethlehem. Israeli army tanks rolled into the town today. Troops have commandeered two hotels, and pressure is mounting on Palestinians following the assassination Wednesday of an Israeli cabinet minister. The U.S. State Department is warning Israel to stop military incursions into Palestinian areas. A temporary jump in gasoline costs pushed consumer prices higher in September, but the government says lower energy costs since then, along with the slumping economy, should keep inflation in check. The Labor Department says the consumer price index rose 0.4% last month. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Wellington Management, providing investment advice to clients worldwide, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Living Terrors, What America Needs to Know to Survive the Coming Bioterrorist Catastrophe, by Dr. Michael Osterholm and John Schwartz.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've got some great music coming up. Loudon Wainwright is going to perform some new songs, including one about New York after September 11th. But first, let's face it, we've all been feeling a little tense. So we called up psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton, who's been devoting his life to studying terrorism, Nazis, and the anxiety caused by the existence of nuclear weapons. He's about to join the Harvard faculty as a visiting professor. His books include Destroying the World to Save It, Om Shinrikyo, Apocalyptic Violence, and the New Global Terrorism. I think a lot of us are really confused by the mixed messages we're getting. Go about your normal business, but another terrorist attack is imminent. Or go back to regular life, but the House of Representatives is shut down because of anthrax. What's the sensible way of behaving in the light of these mixed messages?
Well, of course, it's confusing. And one has to start by saying that the whole bioterrorism has to do with a new dimension of vulnerability affecting one's body that people can feel, even though the letters aren't going to them. They're going to news companies or officials. But when you're told conflicting instructions, you don't know what to do. It plays into a double life we're living already. In other words, we all go about our work, our everyday requirements, and yet there's a corner of the self or part of the self that is terrified, that really responds to the terror, and that wonders where the next blow will come from. And these confused instructions add to that dissociation in each of us, that separation into two selves, which are confusing because they can't really join into one person who's responding reasonably.
Do you have any advice on how to deal with that double life?
Well, I think that the sooner and the better our ability to bring together these two aspects of the self, the healthier we can be. That means trying to take in a real danger and yet evaluate it reasonably. And interestingly, and maybe surprisingly, the voices that have been most steady and that have had, I think, the most constructive effect on us have been some of the doctors. Not all of them, but most of them have spoken in a level way about what the danger is and why it's limited. And people can respond and really improve their feelings from that. But on the other hand, most of our political leaders have given us pep talks like cheerleaders. And I don't think people believe them. They say everything will be fine and America's great, don't worry. But they're not really giving a level statement about what we're really confronting. And then in their behavior, as you said, in closing down the House of Representatives, I think that was very troubling, even frightening to Americans.
You've studied terrorism, you've studied nuclear war, Nazi doctors, cult groups that unleash evil like Om Shinrikyo.
Do you think we're encountering like a new kind of evil where the attackers don't even take credit for the attacks? They don't give demands. There's no way of directly addressing them.
Well, that's right. I mean, first of all, the attackers can be elusive and unclear as to who they are. But there's also this apocalyptic dimension, which really means there are no restrictions on what they do. One of the sources of fear with germ warfare is that it's going against a taboo that we've had, and it violates that taboo, and there's a sense that the terrorists would have no limits in what they do, because what we might consider the necessity for moral limits, they would see as in the service of a higher spiritual cause, that justifying anything they do. So, yes, this can confuse us further, and yet I think we're capable of taking in a reasonable estimate of what's going on.
Because you've studied so many different forms of evil, are you in awe at how creative evil people can be in the forces that they want to unleash?
I'm not in awe of it. I think one has to recognize that in this case, the terrorists have been ingenious, certainly in that weird and almost kitsch-like attack on the World Trade Center. It was imaginative, but some of the imagination could have come from American grade B films, television programs, and computer games, video games, in which we have planes crashing into buildings. So, yes, they're ingenious, but they may be appropriating some of our own imagination. And I think also there's a danger of overestimating the terrorists, seeing them as omnipotent, seeing them as able to manipulate us in every possible way, and our being unable to combat them in any effective way. I think that's wrong.
I mean, we give them more power than they have.
We may give them absolute power, because right now I think we are being manipulated by them, because, you know, I think the best response to terror is a kind of steady and strong approach which tries to get at the terrorists. But I think if we get bellicose and bombastic as our war rhetoric, which I think is mistaken, and I think I'm very uneasy about the war itself that we're fighting, it doesn't seem to be a focus on the terrorism as such. And in that sense, the terrorists evoke from us a kind of maximum response of fear and aggressiveness, whereas the ideal response would be a kind of quiet strength and combating them in every kind of way in a more quiet tone. And we haven't really achieved that.
Robert J. Lifton, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Robert J. Lifton is about to become a visiting professor of psychiatry at Harvard. Okay, it's time for some music. Joining us to perform some of his new songs, including one about September 11th, is Loudon Wainwright. He has a new CD called Last Man on Earth. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has described Wainwright as writing scabrous, ruthlessly honest, funny because it hurts songs about marriage, philandering, divorce, parenthood, drunkenness, and death. Wainwright is now co-starring as the father on the new Fox sitcom Undeclared. Loudon Wainwright, welcome back to Fresh Air.
It's nice to be here.
Now, I know you wrote a new song after the attack on the World Trade Center, so I'd love for you to sing it for us. But before you do, tell us about writing the song and what you were thinking of when you wrote it.
People were asking me if I thought I was going to write a song about it, and my answer was no, because it struck me that it was so immense that it would be ridiculous to even try. So I was surprised when, after that disclaimer, to get an idea and then to actually write the song, which is pretty much just a description of a subway journey underneath the Trade Center.
And is it a subway journey you took on a particular day?
Yeah, I took it a few days after the 11th. But I live in Brooklyn Heights, which is just across the East River from Lower Manhattan. So it's a subway. It's my journey into town that I take pretty much all the time.
Would you play the song for us?
Sure. So I started out on High Street
had to travel into town. Like some Morpheus descending through a turnstile underground, from Brooklyn Heights into Manhattan, which was where I had to be. Now you have to take the A train, since there's no service on the C. And when you are underwater, sometimes the mind plays tricks, and there beneath the East River, it felt like the river Styx. The first stop was Broadway, Nassau. A few more passengers got in. We all sat, no one was standing. There somewhere we'd never been. They say heaven's high above us, and hell is far below. But in that subway tunnel, there was no sure way to know. Chambers Street, a closed ghost station. Passing through, we seem to glide like prisoners inside compartments on some house of horrors ride. The walls were tiled, I hadn't noticed. They seemed so antiseptic, clean. But we knew what we were under. The lights were on. That seemed obscene. And there I saw the three initials, W, T, and then C. I'd survived somehow, was living, but somewhere I shouldn't be. At the next stop, the doors opened, and I emerged up above ground. I was in another country. Elysian Fields, no Chinatown. They say heaven's high above us, and hell's not far below. But standing on Canal Street, there was no sure way to know. Standing on Canal Street, there was no sure way to go.
Loudon, that's a great song. I'm really glad you wrote it. I'm wondering if some of your old songs are feeling almost irrelevant now, if people are just so fixated on the fears and anxieties of the moment that no other fears and anxieties expressed through art or song are quite measuring up, if you know what I mean.
Well, actually, I've been doing a lot of shows since the the 11th. And I'm finding that audiences are really happy to be in a show and to be at my show. I mean, I certainly don't start the set with that song, the World Trade Center song. I mean, I finish with it, but the audiences seem to be happy to coming out and listening to the songs.
My guest is Loudon Wainwright. He has a new CD called Last Man on Earth. He'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Well, we're all in this together, trying to figure out what normal life is like in the face of terrorism. I hope what you're hearing on public radio is helping you keep informed but not panicked. We're going to take a break here to remind you that part of normal life for us is raising enough money to keep going. This fundraiser is essential for the station's future, so please call with a pledge. My guest is singer, songwriter, and guitarist Loudon Wainwright. He has a new CD called Last Man on Earth. You have an older song that sounds pretty prescient now. It's called Hard Day on the Planet. Can you talk about what inspired you to write this and what it was like for you when you realized that some of the lines in the song are exactly about what's been happening?
Yeah. Well, I wrote the song in 1985. I was living in London then, and I was watching Live Aid on television, and started to write this song, "Hard Day on the Planet," and then I sang it a lot, and it seemed very topical at the time. And then things kind of seemed to we forgot about the Ethiopia or the famine, and I stopped singing it for a while, and then but I brought it back every couple of years, it seems, and it is strange that there are a few things mentioned in the song which are specifically what happened.
Why don't you play some of it for us?
Yeah, it's it's a. The dollar went down and the president's sick. Who's in charge now? I don't know. Take your pick. A new disease every day and the old ones are coming back. Things are looking kind of gray, like they're gonna get black. Don't turn on the TV, don't show me the paper. Don't want to know he got kidnapped or why they all raped her. I want to go on vacation till the pressure lets up. But they keep hijacking airplanes and blowing them up. It's been a hard day on the planet. How much is it all worth? It's getting harder to understand it. Things are tough all over on Earth. Yeah. It's hot in December and it's cold in July. When it rains, it pours out of a poisonous sky. In California, the body counts keep getting higher. It's evil out there, man. That state is always on fire. Everyone has a system, but they can't seem to win. Even Bob Geldof looks alarmingly thin. I got to get on that shuttle and get out of this place. But there's gonna be warfare up there in outer space. It's been a hard day on the planet. How much is it all worth? Getting harder and harder to understand. Things are tough all over on Earth, yeah. And then there's a couple of more verses.
That's Loudon Wainwright performing a song he wrote in 1985. And you were thinking then about hijackers blowing up planes, huh?
I was the Nostradamus of my...
So how are you handling all the anxiety? Is it getting to you?
Well, sure it is. I mean, you know, I was. Yeah, I mean, it's getting to. Sure it is. I'm just trying to, like everybody else, conduct my life and move through it and process it. But it's an anxious time, and the deck's been reshuffled, and it's very strange. I'm sure for everybody.
Meanwhile, you know, at the same time that all this calamity is happening in the world, you're on a new sitcom.
That's right. A wacky sitcom playing a goofy dad.
Yes. It's such a funny time for that. It's a new Fox sitcom called Undeclared. And yeah, you're the father of a college freshman. Your wife has just left you. So you've got some time on your hands, and you keep showing up on campus, visiting your son at embarrassing and inopportune moments. The character of the dad that you play is kind of goofy and broad, which, from the little I know of you, seems unlike you.
Well, it is. It's like me, but much worse. Maybe better. I don't know. It's an exaggerated thing, I suppose. But he's a bit of a sad sack.
So do you think,
unlike myself, of course?
Right. Do you think they'll get you to sing on TV?
Well, they have actually. There's an episode where it hasn't been shown yet, but we've shot it of Adam Sandler playing himself comes to the college to do a concert and then gets lured into a party back at the dorm, and Hal, my character, is there because I'm a huge Sandman fan. And I just so happen to have written a song. I play the guitar badly and sing. My character does. Of course, not in real life. But so I wrote this kind of stupid song, which I perform for Adam Sandler. And it's pretty funny, actually, his reaction to it, anyway.
I suppose I shouldn't ask you to do it for us since it hasn't
been
done yet. Sure,
go ahead, ask me, Terry. I can do it. Here's a little piece of it.
Okay.
This is about my ex-wife leaving me, Deborah. You thought you were so cool, treat me like a tool. No, you thought you were so cool, treat me like a fool. But I'm more than a tool, baby, I'm a man. Da, 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 da. You know, it's like that.
It's that's great.
Something that I myself wouldn't have written. But.
and to hear the whole song, I guess we should tune in to Undeclared in future episodes.
Yeah. We can show that one in November sometime.
Loudon Wainwright will be back in the second half of the show. His new CD is called Last Man on Earth. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
We said we would keep in touch, but we're way out of reach. We stopped writing months ago, and we haven't talked in weeks. But today I'm gonna call you just to prove that I still care. But I'm so afraid you'll answer that I hope you won't be there.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Loudon Wainwright performs a couple of songs from his new CD, Last Man on Earth. Thank you.
Major support for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. Support also comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with singer, songwriter, and guitarist Loudon Wainwright. He has a new CD called Last Man on Earth. Wainwright writes very funny, satirical songs and very moving songs. He's performed many of his topical songs on NPR's Morning Edition. He's now co-starring in the new Fox sitcom, Undeclared. Wainwright plays the father of a college freshman. He brought his guitar to the studio. I want to talk with you about your new CD, Last Man on Earth. Most of the songs on here were written after your mother's death, and her death really hangs over the CD. A lot of the songs are about your reaction to that, and also, I think, your reaction to the breakup of a relationship that ended around the same time that your mother died. People often expect that you'll be prepared for the death of an older parent when you're an adult, but that's not necessarily the case. This really hit you hard.
Yeah, I knew. I knew that when my mother, if and when my mother died, it was going to be bad. But I had no idea that it was going to be that it was going to hit me as hard as it did, and I kind of shut down. I was still living in England then, and but this relationship that you mentioned was also ending, but I just kind of came back to New York, up in Westchester, where I grew up, and wound up living in the actual cottage that she had lived in for the last couple of years of her life, surrounded by all the relics of, my life, a lot of them anyway, the furniture and the plates and the pots and the pans, and I was there for about 18 months. At first I didn't write any songs. It wasn't writer's block as much as just kind of a general depression about what had happened. But when I started to feel better, I started to write again. And what I wrote, and it was a big, big thing. And I wrote a lot of songs about it, which are on this record.
You said you were surrounded by the relics of your childhood when you moved into your mother's house. What were some of the objects that had the most, like, flashback power for you?
Oh, well, I mean, there's this plate, it was a set of plates. There's probably three left, and maybe now they're all gone since I've moved out. But just the a plate that had a, I don't know what they call it, a print or a design on it that just, I ate hamburgers off of that plate in 1963, just very powerful. And, the lamps and the furniture, the couch, which I was sitting on or napping on or slouching in. And my father's desk was in this cottage, so that was interesting to go sit at that. So in a way I could visit with both of them or something. I don't know. Eventually it got to be too much and I moved out.
I'm going to ask you to do a song from this new CD called I'm Not Gonna Cry.
Yeah.
What's the story behind this song?
Well, actually, I mentioned the fact that I kind of shut down. I wasn't writing. And this was the first song that I wrote. I used to have a terrible time crying when I was in my 30s and even my 40s, but that's changed now. And at that time, I was crying a lot, which again was totally appropriate. But it wasn't feeling great. I was getting sick of it. So I guess that was the beginning of this song. Normally I play this on the banjo, which is folk music's happy instrument, as we all know. But this is on the guitar. I'm not gonna cry today. I won't shed a tear. Even if some milk is spilt, I won't dilute my beer.
I won't use a tissue and my pillow will stay dry. I won't need a shoulder, cause I'm not gonna cry. I'm not gonna snivel and I'm not gonna sob. Both my eyes will remain dry and I won't have to daub them. Move me with a tragedy, just go ahead and try. Play me a tearjerker, but I'm not gonna cry. I'm not gonna weep today, I will not wet my cheek. I'll count to 10 and I'll hold it in, I'm not gonna leak. I'm not gonna lose it, though I may wanna die. They say it's good to let it out, but I'm not gonna cry. I'm not gonna blub today and I'm not gonna bawl. I'm not gonna fall apart, even if you call me. I couldn't cry for 40 years, I was too tough a guy. Now I can do it anytime, but I'm not gonna cry. I must have cried a million tears, at least 96. I cried me a river and an ocean just for kicks. Listen to the thunder, dark clouds fill the sky. Well, it looks like rain and I hear a train, but I'm not gonna cry. Yeah, well, it looks like rain and I hear a train, but I'm not gonna cry.
Loudon Wainwright performing his song, I'm Not Gonna Cry. The song is also on his new CD, Last Man on Earth. He'll perform more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer, songwriter, and guitarist Loudon Wainwright. He has a new CD called Last Man on Earth. A lot of the songs on your new CD are very personal and really pretty sad. Are those songs any harder to perform in concert than your songs that are social satires?
No, they're not hard to perform. I mean, they're... I mean, it's a show, so I execute. I just do that. I perform them. I mean, I can get caught up in the emotion of the song sometimes, but that's a comfortable thing for me because I'm a performer, and I write my songs mostly to be performed. So it doesn't feel like any kind of an invasion, even when I get caught up in the emotion of the song. I mean, an invasion of privacy. And if I sense that the audience is being affected by the song, that's a gratifying feeling, I suppose.
I'm going to ask you to do another song from your new CD, Last Man on Earth. And this is called Homeless. The song is about your mother. Would you say something about the song?
I knew that I was going to feel bad when my mother died. I didn't know how bad. She was kind of my biggest fan, and I actually mentioned in the second verse of this song, singing. I sang this old. I have a memory of singing this old folk song called "Rosin the Bow" for my mother and my aunt Mary, who was her twin sister. And this would have been when I was about 7, and I was a
a smash hit. I mean, it was in Aunt Mary's Kitchen, and they loved it, and they clapped, and, oh, Loudy, you're so great. And I mean, it was really the reason I got into show business, in a sense. You know, that's all it took. And from then on, I knew that I wanted to be, some kind of a performer. It was that powerful an experience. And I suppose this song relates to just the process of trying to feel better when you're feeling bad. When you were alive, I was never alone. Somewhere in the world, there was something called home. And as long as you lived, I would be all right. There were reasons to win and incentives to fight. I'm smoking again. I thought all that was through, and I don't wanna live, but what else can I do? And I feel like I've faked all that I ever did, and I've grown a gray beard, but I cry like a kid. I was 7 when I sang you rosin the bowl there in Aunt Mary's kitchen, and I don't guess I know that it's why I've done this for all of this time. But now playing and singing seems a game or a crime. People have called to find out if I'm fine. I assure them I am, but I'm not. It's a line. They say in the end your good friends pull you through, but everyone knows my best friend was you. Hey, I've gotten some help. I guess I was afraid. You suppose something will happen when someone is paid. But I am getting better. Once again, I'll be strong. After all, listen, I'm singing this song. Alive, I was never alone. Somewhere in the world, there was something called home. Now I feel like I'm homeless, but I will be all right. I'll get through the days, I'll face down the night.
That's Loudon Wainwright performing a song that's also on his new CD called Last Man on Earth. That's just a wonderful, really expressive song that I think we'll be making many of us sad as we listen to it. I think it's so amazing, Loudon, that you at once can write songs that are really kind of cynical and funny and sarcastic. Then you can turn around and write something that's so really like emotionally naked and moving.
I don't know of many people who can do both of those.
I guess that's a good thing. I mean, it's a, in, when I'm doing a show, you know, I'm performing for 75 minutes. It's useful, I suppose, to be able to do both of those things. You know, you can be having some real fun with the audience and singing along and singing about a dead skunk or whatever, and then all of a sudden you can slip one of these other songs in, and it's a kind of an effective way to engage the group.
The songs you've been doing for us, songs which I've requested, have been particularly sad or about, you know, fear or anxiety or the attack on the World Trade Center. So I think I'll ask you to do a song that's more upbeat.
Sure thing. There'll be lots of drinking in heaven, smoking and eating and sex. What you didn't do in this life bad for you will be totally cool in the next. In heaven there'll be beer for breakfast. At lunch it's tequila and wine. And the soup served with dinner is made with paint thinner. And the morning hereafter feels fine. Oh, good behavior will get you to heaven. It's Beulah Land, that's where you're bound. But nobody makes nice up there in paradise. When you get up there, then you get down. And the angels have ashtrays in heaven. St. Peter puffs on a cigar. That's right, smoking's allowed. It's what makes all those clouds. And you don't have to sit at the bar. It's a guitar solo. I am in the AFM. That's the American Federation of Musicians. Local 802 here in New York. And they eat all day long up in heaven, and nobody ever gets fat. No, not one calorie, and the ice cream is free. It comes in a pint, quart, or a vat. And it's just one big orgy in heaven, and nobody ever says no. And it's front, sideways, back, and you start to lose track, but you don't lose your get up and go. Whoa, there'll be lots of drinking in heaven, smoking and eating and sex. What you didn't do in this life bad for you will be totally cool in the next. In heaven there'll be beer for breakfast. At lunch it's sambuca and wine. The gazpacho with dinner is made with paint thinner, and the morning hereafter feels fine.
That's great. That's Loudon Wainwright. Loudon, thank you so much for performing. You're really terrific. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Loudon Wainwright's new CD is called Last Man on Earth. He's also co-starring in the new Fox sitcom, Undeclared. Loudon Wainwright is on tour. He performs tonight in Denver, then goes on to Seattle, Pittsburgh, Ann Arbor, Chicago, L.A., Portland, San Francisco, and other cities. This is Fresh Air. I know there's a lot of uncertainty in your life right now, but here's something you can be sure of. If you make a pledge, it will help keep public radio here for you at a time when you're really depending on it. Thank you so much for the support that you've given us. Thank you.
David Lynch's new film, Mulholland Drive, was originally conceived as a network TV pilot, but the pilot was rejected. Our film critic John Powers hopes that Mulholland Drive finds its audience in spite of fears about terrorism.
The novelist David Foster Wallace once gave the best explanation I've heard of why the movies of David Lynch can be so unsettling. With ordinary movies, Wallace said, you know that you're dealing with stories clearly intended to make you laugh or cry or shriek or go wow. But that's not true of a Lynch film, which gets under your skin precisely because you don't know what it wants from you. It enters you like a dream. That's exactly what happens with Mulholland Drive, a corrosively beautiful fairy tale that's as mysterious as the inky shadows that lie just beyond the reach of our headlights. It centers on the Apache dance of two wildly different women, one fair and one dark, rather like Snow White and Rose Red. The brunette is a hard-faced sexpot known as Rita, nicely played by Laura Elena Herring, who develops amnesia after a car crash on L.A.'s Mulholland Drive. She stumbles into the home of Betty Elms, an innocent blonde played by Naomi Watts, who's moved to Hollywood from Deep River, Ontario, in order to become an actress. The generous Betty takes Rita in and helps investigate who she is and what's happened to her. Along the way, they get involved with a beleaguered movie director played by Justin Theroux, who has his own problems, with gangsters and a sinister cowboy who seems to come from outer space. As Betty and Rita go sleuthing, they even find an enigmatic corpse, their relationship gets deeper and more complicated. Here, Betty urges Rita to start exploring Hollywood to find out what, if anything, happened to her on Mulholland Drive.
I wonder where you were going. Mulholland Drive. Mulholland Drive. That's where I was going. Mulholland Drive. Maybe that's where the accident was. There must be a police report we could call. No. We could call anonymously from a payphone just to see if there was an accident. Come on, it'll be just like in the movies. We'll pretend to be someone else. I want to walk around anyway. I'm in Hollywood, and I haven't even seen any of it. Come on, Rita, do you feel up to it? Okay. But just to see.
The movie marks an extraordinary comeback for Lynch, who began the 90s on the cover of Time magazine and ended it off the cultural radar. Well, he's back now with a vengeance. In fact, along with Eraserhead, Blue Velvet, Twin Peaks, and Fire Walk With Me, this new movie reminds us that Lynch is one of the handful of our filmmakers who's been brushed by genius. Mulholland Drive isn't just the most thrilling American movie of the year. It's probably the best movie set in Hollywood since Sunset Boulevard. Wildly ambitious and wantonly intuitive, it's a touching love story, a portrait of L.A. illusions, a postmodern slice of film noir, a club-footed satire of the movie business, and a radical vision of the human psyche. It's also a puzzle of sorts. The movie takes a strange turn maybe 35 minutes from the end, and many viewers leave the theater asking, what happened? You thought the movie was one thing, and suddenly it gets weird. Without giving anything away, I'll only say that the pieces all do fit together, and that the kind of person who saw Memento two or three times will dig this movie too. For it's filled with clues, and the things you ignore at the beginning help to explain the end. But it's not primarily a puzzle. Mulholland Drive is about Hollywood, how it fills our hearts with dreams and then grinds them up. It's about how we spin stories in order to make life beautiful, or sometimes just bearable. The film's vision is bleak, for Lynch no longer seems to believe in any kind of solid, stable self. He portrays human identity as a series of trapdoors through which we tumble. Or perhaps the self is an onion. Peel off its layers, and there's nothing left but silence. Lynch's last movie was The Straight Story. This is a crooked one, but it's also his tenderest and most human work since The Elephant Man. He never loses sight of his heroine's frailty amidst all the hallucinations, mistaken identities, performances within performances, and dreams within dreams within dreams. And he gets a miraculous performance from Naomi Watts, an unknown Australian actress who's asked to do everything, laugh and cry and make love and seem stupid and seem bitter, and show how an aspiring actress will play a role when rehearsing clumsily with a friend, and how she reads it later when doing the same lines superbly in an audition. Watts takes Betty from wide-eyed wonder to a lacerating awareness of human emptiness, and it's by miles the best performance of the year. She perfectly embodies what Lynch's best work has always been at pains to show us, that heaven and hell don't exist outside our heads, that we are our own brightest dreams and darkest nightmares.
John Powers is executive editor of LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Hall, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Charles Sennett. He's been reporting from Afghanistan for the Boston Globe. He's the Globe's former Middle East bureau chief. His new book examines why Christianity is disappearing in the Middle East, where it began. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.